Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. This week's Geriatric Journal Club is a joint presentation of the Florida Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.
Good morning, everyone, or now afternoon. I want to thank you for attending another one of our journal clubs. This should be exciting and interesting because we're going to talk today about pharmaceutical updates and emerging research. I want to start with, of course, as typical, going through our state of the state. And hopefully we'll have enough time at the end to really go into any of your questions. I invite you to put your questions in the chat as we go along, just so that we can keep track of it and make sure we ask everything that you may have an inquiry about. I want to start first with just talking about where we're at globally. We're over 20 million cases and over 740,000 deaths globally. The United States makes up about 22% of those global deaths. If you go to the next slide for me, Shane, you'll see that in the US, we're at over 5.1 million cases. There is some discrepancy between some of the different websites. This is from Johns Hopkins, but the Worldometer is tracking a little higher. We have in the United States over 1.7 million people who've recovered, and our positivity rate is 6.79%. So we're still above where the World Health Organization recommends us to be for reopening, despite seeing reopenings in a lot of states and a lot of things still actively open, and some of us having states where we're seeing schools being reopened as well. If you go to the next slide for me, you know, this is from the Johns Hopkins site as well. And it just lays out the positivity rates, the infection rates of all the states. 38 states are higher than recommended. Florida's positivity rate sits at about 17.7%. There was some discrepancy in some of the, I would say, the news reportings this week, but we're at 17.7% as of this morning. I'm still trying to figure out what's happening in Washington State. I believe in the past 7 days, which is where this trending report comes from, they've had every case that they've tested has been positive. Now, it's much lower numbers, but this is just a general look at the percentage of positive tests versus the number of people, like, so the percentage of tests versus number of people who come back positive. So in Washington, it's being reported that they have 100% positivity rate, and in Puerto Rico, they have 100% positivity rate. So I've been on their website trying to figure out what's going on in both of those areas and haven't received any guidance yet. If we have somebody in Washington, from Washington, we may ask you to just give your 2 cents later in this conversation. If you go to the next slide for me, in Florida, we're over 550,000 cases now, Miami-Dade being the hardest hit of the counties. There was a lot of news yesterday because Florida had reported 270 deaths. So, I don't think there's any issue, any discrepancy here with us understanding that in the state of Florida, we're the hot spot down here in South Florida. Where I'm at, it would be on fire still. And we still have a long ways to go. In the nursing home, if you go to the next slide, the good news there is that, you know, we are testing the SNFs and the ALFs, both the residents, and we're testing the staffs according to CDC guidance and CMS guidance. The positivity rates are lower for our residents, so about 3.82%, and for our staff is 2.78%, so that's good news. There has been some news made, I believe, over the weekend about facilities not allowing state officials in, and there's a lot that we need to consider. We need them to be screened and those kind of things. But there has been some issues and some emergency rules around that from the governor's office stating that you have to allow state officials in. So we are actively on groups talking about that with AMDA and other leadership to see what we need to do and how we need to address those things. But in an effort to keep everything moving and to talk about some of the updates and emerging research, I want to introduce you all to Dr. Dana Saffel. And Dana, I would ask you to unmute yourself and give an introduction to our audience.
Thank you. Thanks for having me in this afternoon. I am a clinical pharmacist with a board certification in geriatrics, and I've practiced in long-term care for over 40 years. I have been working in all different aspects with the long-term care industry in that time period. But in terms of COVID management, I have found this a fascinating molecule that since December. So I've been following the research, been following the results since December. Of course, this has devastated our long-term care community. And we understand that our people that we house in our facilities are the most vulnerable to the poor outcomes. But even with that being said, we have an enormous number of our residents who test positive for COVID and yet survive. We don't understand the condition, and today, even though this is titled a pharmaceutical update, we really have very little guaranteed positive trialed information to report. What we can report is what people are attempting, what seems to be working, what seems to be working at different stages of the infection, what may seem to be working differently regarding the age group and comorbidities. So we have a lot more information now than we did in March when all of this really began in the United States.
Yeah, I would say that has been probably the most challenging thing. And, I don't know what they're gonna write about in history books later about how we approach this, but being in this pandemic and learning something new every week has presented quite a challenge, an uphill battle, if you will. And I think the biggest thing is that probably the most questions that I receive is about, okay, what can we use? Is there something we should be doing? What treatment protocols are out there? So Shade, if you would advance to the next slide, the first thing I wanted to just pick your brain about, Dana, is on vaccinations. We are seeing in the news every day that there's progress being made on the vaccines. I think Russia stated that they had a vaccine that was ready to go. There's a lot of discussion on within the NIH on how we should be looking at immunity. And I just wanted to get your thoughts around all of that.
Absolutely. So we have about 163 vaccine candidates that are under development, but about six of them look like they will be, if they prove to be effective, available by early to mid 2021 in the United States. Of those six, there are three different mechanisms of creating the vaccine. So we have several candidates that are an RNA, a modified RNA vaccine, where they're basically taking a piece of the coronavirus and that is immunogenic, that's stimulating an immune response, but will not cause active disease. Then there's an approach that Oxford is taking, which is based off an adenovirus. So they're taking a different type of virus that doesn't seem to cause a severe disease, and they're making it immunogenic for the proteins that are in the coronavirus. So we have different mechanisms, three different mechanisms. It appears all of them now, all six of these have passed phase one, showing that they will stimulate an immune response. Here's the question. Is the immune response that they generate going to be effective in preventing infection, or is it even going to last for more than a few months? It does appear that in all the viruses, you need to have two injections. So similar to the shingles virus and some other shingles vaccinations and other vaccinations, we're going to have to double vaccinate people to get an usable immune response. All of these are also stimulating neutralizing antibodies. So they're stimulating IgM and primarily IgG, which is the long immune antibody that we're looking for that targets coronavirus. And we still don't know how long that's going to last. Unfortunately, there's been a lot of media reports that there's a wane in the IgG and IgM that may indicate that it only lasts 3 to 6 months, in which case we would have to vaccinate perhaps twice a year, which is a pretty extensive, it's hard enough to get people to vaccinate for flu, and we've had that vaccine around for 40 years. So getting people vaccinated twice a year with a two-dose vaccination is very problematic. So set all of that aside, none of this has been answered. We also now have a lot of evidence coming out about memory B and memory T cells. And there's a lot of research ongoing now to determine whether, in fact, long-term immunity for SARS-CoV-2 for the current coronavirus may in fact be driven by T cells. So T cells are cells that actually travel to the site of the infection, and they kill the virus, and they also kill the cell that the virus is in. So they effectively remove the virus from the body. They get stimulated by the actions of typically the neutralizing antibodies, the IgM and IgG, in a new person that's never been exposed. However, if we've ever been exposed in the past, the T cells activate very rapidly. So there's now a thought that perhaps long-term immunity may be more T cell driven than it is the antibodies. So we don't have any way of necessarily activating T cells, but that would help us that if we ever were infected, we may have long-term immunity, and that is remaining to be researched. The last thing I'll mention is that because there's a concern that there may not be a robust IgM, IgG antibody response to vaccines once we have them available, there are a number of companies, Regeneron and Eli Lilly, are both testing antibodies that would be delivered, the initial ones IV. So for perhaps immunocompromised individuals or elderly individuals that are just because of their age, unable to host a strong immune response to the vaccine, they may be candidates for just directly injecting them with the antibodies that would then fight the virus should they get exposed. So a lot of things in the fire in terms of vaccinations and providing antibody support.
For those studies that are looking at antibody support, what phase are they in? Is it still more emerging, or are they actually doing trials?
They're doing trials and they're in phase two or three. Eli Lilly's product, which is a monoclonal antibody, but it's a specifically lab-derived antibody to mimic the role of the neutralizing antibodies that we have obtained from convalescent plasma. That is actually starting in phase three trials, and they actually have an arm specifically testing in nursing home patients. I believe they have an agreement with Symphony Nursing Homes, and so they'll be getting data in their phase three trials from nursing home patients.
That's so interesting. I think, we talked on this platform a few weeks ago about a couple of emerging research around the memory T cells. And, you know, in just thinking about that, are you seeing any clinical trials or pharmaceutical trials in which they're doing more research other than some of the things that have already been reported by the NIH?
No, I've not seen much reported at all. It's very piecemeal out with the T cells. I think in the beginning, no one was really looking at T cells because we thought we would just take a straight antibody vaccine approach and we have it fixed. Although I don't know why people thought that. We have had coronaviruses around for hundreds of years, and we've been looking for a cure for the common cold, which is not just coronavirus, but enteroviruses, rhinoviruses. There's all kinds of different viruses that cause the cold, and we've never been successful with the coronaviruses in the past. But I think because our efforts to getting a vaccine to market are not meeting expectations that people want. They're looking at other alternatives. Or if the fear is our antibodies do decline in a short period of time after vaccination, they're looking for alternatives that might explain why we have so many asymptomatic cases or so many people with very mild disease that recover. There's a thought now is that exposure to previous coronaviruses in your lifetime may allow your T cells to activate and be effective in fighting the novel coronavirus, so that perhaps those people may have a milder condition or be asymptomatic because they had a lot of colds when they were growing up. There's also some interesting concepts, and I don't know, I have not been able to determine the validity of the science, but there's some interesting concepts that previous vaccinations may offer some degree of protection against the coronavirus vaccination. And in particular, they were talking about poliovirus. So if you've how many of us have had a recent poliovirus vaccine? Probably but not very many of us. But a recent pneumococcal vaccination may perhaps be providing some degree of protection. And of course, we all recommend a pneumococcal vaccination between the age of 60 and 65, and then we typically revaccinate every 5 years after that. So we could have portions of our nursing home populations that have had a recent pneumococcal vaccination. It would be interesting to know whether or not those people tend to have a different outcome. But then this is all just hypothesis, it's postulations out there. I find it interesting, but we don't have valid data on it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's definitely a more to come, and we're sitting on the edge of our seats trying to figure out what's happening, what's coming. So I thank you, because it is really hard to keep track of all of the trials and what is happening all across the world. I want to talk to you about what we are doing, and as far as medications that we've seen utilized, all off-label, some with emergency authorizations, but nothing, of course, confirmed that we know of. But just curious to know your thoughts, and we can start maybe with remdesivir. I'm very interested in knowing what you think about that medication that we've seen utilized and seen some promising research about.
So remdesivir is a drug that has been in development for a dozen years and has failed all of its FDA approvals until coronavirus. So they attempted that drug for Ebola. They've attempted it for other viral indications. It's not shown efficacy, but when coronavirus hit the world, everybody dusted off every antiviral that was in the file cabinets and said, let's throw it at coronavirus and see what we get. Remdesivir had a number of poor trials in the beginning, but they did have one trial which indicated that it reduced the length of time that the patients were in the hospital from 15 days down to 11 days. So it basically reduced the length of time of hospitalization by 4 days. And there was a trend towards improved mortality, but that was not statistically different. In the normal world, that would never have received an emergency use authorization, in my opinion. But in a world with nothing else to go with, it was the best evidence we had. So it received, of course, the emergency use authorization. Currently, remdesivir is an IV drug. Currently, it's allocated because there's only a certain amount that was ever manufactured. Gilead did donate all of the existing Gilead remdesivir that it had to the national stockpile. It donated what it had made up until that point, which I think was enough to last until June or July. So donated its entire inventory for free to the national stockpile. They have filed for FDA approval. They have a brand name, Vectory or something like that, a real unusual brand name. We're all going to call it remdesivir forever. So, but it has a brand name. It's filed for FDA approval. We'll probably get that approval. And at which point it's going to be costing about $2,000 for a 5-day treatment. So it is still an IV drug, which means it's really not readily available for most of us to use in our nursing homes for two reasons. One is many of our homes, we're not introducing IV therapy in our infection control units where our COVID patients are because of risk of exposure. And it's also not going to be given to us because even though it may become commercially available, the allocations are going to primarily go to the hospitals. Now, Gilead is investigating a nasal application for remdesivir, an inhaled, not necessarily nasal, maybe oral. I may have misread the nasal somewhere, but it's going to be an inhaled version of remdesivir. And ideally, if this does work, if the data becomes even more robust about its efficacy in coronaviruses, an inhaled formulation would be ideal for people that are in early stages, that are living at home, that need to treat mild symptoms. But right now, remdesivir is being held until relatively late stage. And one could question that. I mean, in my opinion, the time to treat COVID is at the first identification of a positive result. Understanding, of course, some of those positive results can be false positives. I perhaps would not initiate antiviral treatment in an asymptomatic person because presumably their body is fighting that virus just fine. But I would want to implement antiviral treatment in a mildly symptomatic person at the earliest stages in their infection. And to be waiting until someone is bad enough to be hospitalized to start treatment, to me, is the reason why we're not getting the success rates that we should.
Yeah. I also saw, I think in some parts of Florida where it was being utilized, that they weren't using it for the recommended length of treatment. So I guess they were shortening it by 2 or 3 days because they were trying.
Allocation.
Yeah. So I guess we just don't have any good answers yet on that.
Well, we did find out that originally they were recommending 10 days, and they did do a trial, Gilead did, that showed that you got the same results whether you gave it for 10 days or 5 days, so essentially equal results. So they've now adjusted it to a 5-day treatment protocol. But if all you've got is X amount of drug and you've got more patients, then rather than give some people the drug and other people not, you tend to kind of spread it around. We see that all the time. And elderly people that can't afford their medications, they split them in half or take them every other day. Unfortunately, when you do that, because of the pharmacology of the agent, you sometimes get a failed therapeutic effect.
So I wanted to ask you about hydroxychloroquine, because that's one that I think we all sort of gathered around and said, okay, this in combination with azithromycin maybe a treatment, and there are so many, I would say, testimonials that it worked. And then the research started coming out where we saw that there wasn't any difference or in the clinical outcomes, or they had a poor outcome or death, you know. So I think there was, once we started seeing that literature, we moved away from that. Just curious to know what your thoughts are about it. I know some people still have it on their treatment protocols. Others are going by the latest research, and we also saw the FDA remove the emergency authorization. So where are we at right now?
That's a loaded question. So
sorry,
I'll do my best. So number one, we have a drug that's been on the market for 60 years. It is extraordinarily well tolerated. And outside of the QT prolongation, all of the adverse effects, including the psychiatric effects that made all the medical literature yesterday, are long-term use. I have to tell you, I am absolutely disgusted with politicizing medical treatment, and even with our own profession that seems to harp on an adverse effect that is not going to happen in 5 days of treatment, as part of a decision making about what's best for the patient or not. So now that I've gotten off that platform, hydroxychloroquine, if it is going to work, is going to work if it is given immediately upon infection. If you look at the pharmacology, and there are a number of studies that have looked at hydroxychloroquine and its efficacy against SARS-1, if it's going to work, it's going to prevent the initial infection by the virus. So theoretically, it would need to be given prophylactically or within the first 24 hours of the infection. Now, the dose protocol that seems to be most often used, which is 400 milligrams twice a day on day one, followed by 200 milligrams twice a day for the next 4 days, so a 5 day treatment. That seems to be incredibly well tolerated. In the reports where hydroxychloroquine has been shown to cause increase in QT prolongation and increase in death, these were in very severe hospitalized patients that may already have been predisposed to the QT prolongation. As we all know, QT prolongation is an additive effect. So even though hydroxychloroquine by itself may have minimal QT prolonging effect, if you add it to all the other drugs that, and particularly our elderly patients are already taking that prolonged QT interval, we can cause a problem. Both the Mayo Clinic and the group of New York health systems have come out with very clearly defined protocols that you can put your residents or patients through to identify which ones would be appropriate for a potential hydroxychloroquine trial versus those that would not. So we've got protocols out by very well-established entities. And I can tell you that I am familiar with a number of nursing home chains whose corporate medical directors are implementing those protocols. And if the patients do qualify for hydroxychloroquine, they're using it with good success. But it has to be started early. There's absolutely no evidence that using hydroxychloroquine after 24 to 48 hours is going to, the way it works pharmacologically as an antiviral agent is not going to prevent the infection. Now, we actually have a positive, well-designed study out of the Henry Ford Hospital Systems that was a large trial of over 2,000 people. They instituted it in hospitalized patients right at the beginning within 24 hours, most of them within 24 hours of hospitalization, and they found in their results that there was reduced mortality versus those that did not get hydroxychloroquine. They looked at hydroxychloroquine alone, they looked at it with azithromycin and also with zinc. Pharmacologically speaking, if you can institute hydroxychloroquine, it does act as an antiviral. It is effective as an antiviral for multiple viruses because it increases the pH of the cell that makes it an unattractive environment for the vaccine to replicate. So it reduces vaccine replication. Then it also has some immunomodulatory effect to reduce the cytokines that are oftentimes stimulated by the virus replication in the cells. So there's some potential value there. Now the next question is whether is the value there by itself? Is it there if you only give it with azithromycin or doxycycline? both of which, besides being antibacterial and perhaps protecting against any viral-induced pneumonia, are also immunomodulating. So they've also tamped down the interleukin-6 and the interleukin-1 that we know become elevated and may have some effect on TNF-alpha. So that's the theory behind adding hydroxychloroquine and one of those two antibiotics. You choose doxycycline if you're concerned about QT prolongation. If you're in a healthy individual, azithromycin is a 5-day, 2 tablets the first day, 1 each day after. It matches the hydroxychloroquine 5-day. It's a simple regimen for people that you're not concerned about QT prolongation. Concerned about QT prolongation, it's doxycycline, but that's a 7 to 10 day treatment. And it's well tolerated, very few adverse effects. And then the last piece of this is zinc. And there is some questions out there that maybe when you're giving hydroxychloroquine, azithromycin, and zinc, it may be the zinc that's doing all the work. There's a lot of evidence out there showing that zinc is an effective antiviral. We've been using Zicam for years to treat the common cold coronaviruses. We've been using zinc in our emergency and all those different over-the-counter products people buy for colds. Zinc is a good antiviral. It's effective against coronaviruses, but you have to have a zinc ionophore in order for it to get into the cell to work. Hydroxychloroquine is a zinc ionophore. So when you give the two together, you actually do increase the amount of zinc that can get into the cell.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
What is the pharmacology behind zinc's impact? Like how... When we're thinking about this as an antiviral, what is that pharmacology look like? What are we saying as the properties that zinc holds?
It interferes with the RNA polymerase, which is the transcription process that the virus uses to replicate.
And what dose of zinc would be recommended if we had providers who are interested in starting that?
The zinc for prophylaxis, and by this I mean the elemental zinc, should be between 30 and 50 milligrams a day. If you have an active infection, it's recommended to increase up to 100 milligrams a day of elemental zinc. A lot of the zinc we used to use in long-term care to improve wound healing, if you remember back in those days, was the zinc sulfate 220 milligrams. That is providing about 30 milligrams of elemental zinc. But today you can get supplements that are listed by the elemental zinc. So there's a protocol for prophylaxis that I recommend for everybody, and that is increasing vitamin C, increasing vitamin D, zinc, and there's a supplement out there called quercetin, which is just an antioxidant supplement that happens to be a zinc ionophore. So if you take quercetin, zinc, vitamin C, vitamin D, you're maximizing your immune system. And you're also getting enough zinc into the cells that it could act as an antiviral and may have some beneficial effect if your exposure, if your inoculum of the virus is minor. You know, we don't know exactly how many viral particles we have to breathe in to actually stimulate or to overcome our natural immunity and stimulate an infection. But presumably we may have more of a buffer if we do have zinc on board.
No, you mentioned vitamin D as well. And I would say that when I remember when the paper came out about vitamin D, I felt like finally I could convince some of my family members to take it when I purchased it so many times. It's something that I think a lot of geriatricians, you know, live and die by, take your vitamin D. But what is the pharmacology associated with vitamin D in regards to COVID?
So vitamin D is obviously necessary for proper bone metabolism and calcium homeostasis, but it's also an antioxidant. So vitamin D is working in our bodies to scavenge free radicals and to improve our immune system in general. It is the immune modulatory activity of vitamin D that's beneficial as in a viral exposure. So it's not antiviral, but it does stimulate or improve or ensure that our normal cytokine function is stabilized. So if you are deficient in vitamin D, you may not be able to host an adequate immune response to fight the virus in the beginning. Now, there has been some literature, but it's older literature that has suggested that once you become an active infection with coronavirus, you may want to stop the vitamin D because the vitamin D may actually overactivate the cytokines, particularly interleukin-1 and interleukin-6. And it might worsen the cytokine storm. I'm not seeing that in reality. I'm seeing people continuing on their vitamin D even when they have an infection, and it's not seeming to make them any worse. But that there was some concern over that. Elderberry is another supplement that's an antioxidant, antiviral. And there's been some recommendations to avoid elderberry once again because it tends to increase some of the cytokines that we know are involved in the cytokine storm. Altogether, I think what we need to do as healthcare practitioners and particularly people that are caring for the frail elderly, we need to understand that this is two different diseases. There is an initial phase of coronavirus infection that is a relatively mild viral infection. It is essentially a cold, or maybe even a bad cold. And for most of us, our normal immune defenses, especially if we enhance them by taking drugs that improve our immune system, like vitamin C and vitamin D and all these other agents that I've mentioned, we'll be able to fight that virus off and we will recover. Some of us may feel bad for 2 or 3 weeks, I've seen that, but we still recover. However, there's a certain segment of the population that will develop this cytokine storm, and we still do not know what it is. We do know the more comorbidities you have, certain ethnicities, being obese, we understand that those are risk factors, but we don't understand why they're risk factors. And those individuals that develop the cytokine storm and the coagulopathy, those people need to be treated entirely different than the people at the early stage. So we need to have two different treatment strategies. And we shouldn't be giving people hydroxychloroquine once they're having a cytokine storm. That's just going to be a drug interaction that we have to mess with. It's not going to provide any benefit.
Thank you. I think we had a question about high dose Pepcid and steroid use. Do you have any knowledge or recommendations to share about, let's start with the high dose Pepcid? Have you seen any literature showing that works?
So all the information on high dose famotidine, Pepcid, is observational. Mm-hmm. It was interesting. A group of New York physicians that have put out in, I think it was in June's Journal of the American Medical Directors Association, had a protocol where if that person was being treated with GERD and they were on a PPI, they just switched everybody over to famotidine because of this observational status, which showed that there was fewer mortalities in individuals in New York State who had been taking Pepcid the 24 hours before they came into the hospital. So it's not antiviral. There is not anything in the mechanism of famotidine that's antiviral. There is potentially some immune modulating effects of famotidine. So presuming that a lot of the people that end up going into the hospital have an overactive cytokine immune response, a cytokine storm, interleukins, TNF-alpha, all the other involved agents, there could potentially be some tamping of that by the famotidine. But no one is known. This is all speculation, and it's and any effect on famotidine has been observational. I mean, if you're out there right now and you happen to have a little gastric upset and you get to choose between taking omeprazole and famotidine, I'd probably lean on the famotidine side. Why not? They both work. But there's no clear evidence that there's any value. Now, if you have hospitalized patients, we have known for a long time that people are always at risk for hospital-induced gastropathy or GERD, stress-induced GERD. So we tend to treat people in hospitals with a acid-suppressing agent. And so if they are in the hospital and an acid-suppressing agent makes sense for you, famotidine would probably be a good choice because observationally it's beneficial, but we have zero real data on it.
What about steroids? There were some interesting studies that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine, and I believe JAMA, about showing great results with using dexamethasone. If we have providers in the nursing facility, the question I've been asked is, oh, should we start everybody on dexamethasone if we suspect it? What are your thoughts around using steroids?
Steroids are great drugs, and it doesn't have to be dexamethasone. It can be methylprednisolone. It could be prednisone. It can be whatever you have. Now, the role for a steroid is it basically is the blanket that puts out the cytokine fire. In the beginning of the COVID pandemic, we had been told not to use steroids because steroids also prevent the body from being able to fight the virus. So we're interfering with the body's normal antiviral activities. And now we realize the virus, for the most part, isn't what's killing us. It's the cytokine storm that's killing us. Now, I say for the most part, we do have rare instances where we've identified that there's been virus in brain tissue, virus in cardiac tissue, virus in other organ tissue. So there is some potential that the virus could, in fact, cause organ damage that results in death. But the most of the people that die are dying from the cytokine storm. Now that we realize that, there are a lot of trials looking at interleukin 6 inhibitors, interleukin 1 inhibitors, interleukin 10 inhibitors, looking at all these various drugs that are either already on the market or under investigation, most of them used to treat autoimmune diseases, looking at can we go just be surgical and just stop that one cytokine that seems to be causing the problem. But we never know in which individual, that one cytokine is because so many are involved. So now we're back to the steroids. Corticosteroids are like putting a blanket on the fire. They will stop the cytokine storm. And if we can stop it early enough before all the coagulopathies occur, then, the D-dimer levels increasing, but if we can stop it before it causes severe damage, then we can improve our mortality. And that's what we've seen with the Oxford study. That's what we've seen in clinical practice. Now, steroids are not without risk. They can increase the risk of a secondary bacterial infection. They cause havoc on blood glucose control. So if your person is diabetic, they're going to require a significant amount of effort. But I can tell you what I'm seeing in outpatient settings is people with coronavirus that develop more significant illness. They don't need to be hospitalized, but they're running a fever for 10 days, having the cough. A Medrol dose pack does wonders. So, you know, Medrol dose pack isn't even near as high the doses of dexamethasone they recommended in the hospitalized patients. And we're all familiar with the Medrol dose pack, but it seems to be doing very good effect in people with the more moderate severe disease that have still maintained their oxygen saturation above 94.
I would imagine that when we're introducing even a smaller dose, we're just helping to battle, as you said, that inflammatory response, that cytokine storm. I'm interested in knowing, and we're getting so many questions, so that's why we're staying here. What criteria have you, in maybe the pharmacists who you work with, are you utilizing for antithrombotic prophylaxis in the nursing facilities?
Well, that's a good question. Okay, very good question. In the nursing homes, most people are staying on oral antithrombotic agents. If it's mild disease, the recommendation may simply be aspirin therapy, or it could be one of the NOACs, or if it's mild to moderate disease, if it's mild disease, I don't even know that we're prophylaxing. If it's moderate disease, what I am seeing is they're using warfarin because it's generically available and readily available, unless the person is already being coagulated. And if they are, they're leaving it on coagulation. They're not getting aggressive, because there's now some evidence that more aggressive anticoagulation leads to poorer results. So they're just using introductory anticoagulation on people. And many of them are just using aspirin therapy. They're just adding aspirin therapy. Since there's always a risk a nursing home resident can fall, if we overcoagulate, they may be getting well on their COVID, but then have a hematoma and have to go into the hospital. So that's what we're finding on the outpatient setting. And obviously, if you can do any kind of ferritin or D-dimer levels, those are the two factors that seem to become elevated right about the time that we're going to start having a coagulopathy issue. So if you can do those, if you're in an area where you can do lab testing on a daily basis or an every other day basis, that would be good things to watch for, to see whether or not you need to introduce a more aggressive anticoagulant activity. Once they go into the hospital, they're using enoxaparin, Lovenox, or heparin. Again, that's just whatever the protocol in the hospital is. But mild disease, I would not necessarily consider prophylacting on any kind of coagulation therapy. And if it was moderate disease and they were clearly not moving around in bed, where they might be a DVT risk as well, I would definitely do aspirin or perhaps warfarin. Because again, this is short term. We hopefully, the recommendation is once they have recovered from their COVID, you stop the anticoagulation therapy.
So I have two questions that hit the chat. The first is about the cocktail that you mentioned, the zinc, vitamin C, and vitamin D. Are you actively recommending that, do we know if there are any pharmaceutical trials going on that is looking at the use of those supplements?
I am recommending it. The doses that I recommend are vitamin C 500 milligrams twice a day, quercetin 250 milligrams twice a day, and vitamin D at least 2,000 international units a day. And you may even be going higher than that depending on the D levels if you've taken them recently. and then zinc 50 milligrams a day. And that's what I'm recommending all of my elderly and young people that I happen to talk to or influence. Go ahead and start taking just to build up your immune system. And several of those are in trials as adjuvants to some other treatment. This particular prophylactic cocktail has not been specifically tried as itself, but you'll see that zinc is in many, many different trials with azithromycin and hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. We didn't even talk about ivermectin, but yeah. Ivermectin is a FDA-approved human drug to treat parasites. It treats scabies. It treats strongyloidosis, I can't even pronounce this one. Onchocerciasis, which I have never seen in my career, but it's available, and it does appear in vitro to have some antiviral activity. It is incredibly well tolerated, does not cause any QT prolongation at all, and it's a one-dose treatment. Now, does it work? There are pockets of people that are using ivermectin instead of hydroxychloroquine, and they say it works. But here's the thing. If you have 100 people and you give them all ivermectin and they all survive, where they were, perhaps they were all going to survive before anyway. So we don't know outside of a placebo-controlled trial whether this stuff works or not, but it's hard to get people to be willing to be on a placebo if they have hope that something might work. So we're really challenged here in getting good information. I guess if you remember anything from anything I've said today, we're challenged for good information, and without good information, we can't make good decisions, but we do have a lot of options to consider.
Yeah, I think, I mean, if it wasn't, you know, I have this sort of dual appreciation of the time that we're in. I'm like, oh my gosh, there's so much science coming up. And then the other appreciation, like, oh my gosh, when is this going to be over? A question that popped up in the chat that I want to be careful in the way I ask it. I want to, you know, I know there's nothing yet proven to work, but if we are discussing this with our consultant pharmacists and trying to figure out a treatment protocol, would you advocate for the use of hydroxychloroquine, azithromycin, or doxycycline if there's QT prolongation and you're in the supplement cocktail that you introduced?
If that patient was not cardiocompromised, so if we had put them through the protocol, and it's a relatively simple protocol, and ideally you've got some EKG availability, that would be ideal, but if no history of cardiac complications, that would be my recommendation. I know that we don't have evidence necessarily on hydroxychloroquine. Let me tell you this. We don't have a lot of information about hydroxychloroquine in an outpatient setting, and that's what we'll call our nursing home folks. Mm-hmm. We know for a fact that if you wait until somebody is deathly ill and in the hospital, it doesn't do any good. We know for a fact it doesn't work. What we don't know for a fact is whether it works if you give it within 24 hours of getting a positive test. So if I had someone, this is just me, my recommendation, if I had a patient and they were cardiovascularly stable and they had symptoms today and tested positive today, I think a 5-day course of hydroxychloroquine plus, if they can handle azithromycin, there's potential antiviral effect of azithromycin, and definitely the zinc. I would do that, and I would have them already on the zinc and the vitamin C and vitamin D. I would be adding all of those supplements into my nursing home population if they were not already there. There's also some interesting science on melatonin. Melatonin is an antioxidant, and it's actually immunomodulatory to stabilize your cytokine system, as well as providing some benefit potentially in some individuals with sleep. And it may even, you know, maybe antiviral activity in some levels. So So some of the cocktails I recommend may include, and they generally recommend extended release melatonin. And all of, you can Google all of this and you can read it for weeks. It's so much information out there. So every time that I recommend a supplement or a prescription drug be considered, I've made sure that we've got enough information to make some type of a informed decision until we have better information.
Now, if we are in our facilities, and whether we are attendings or the clinical providers or the medical directors, how do you recommend us approaching our consultant pharmacists, or even maybe them approaching us about trying to come up with a protocol? How should we be working with each other in this period of time?
So that depends on who your consultant pharmacist is. I'm a member of AMDA, I'm a member of ASCP, I sit on both sides, I listen to both sides, and there's more of a team approach in many buildings, and if there's a team approach, I highly recommend that all the heads come together and decide what is the best strategy for those particular individuals in your facility. And that may be on a patient by patient basis, or it may be that you feel that that's a protocol you could implement facility wide. I think that having the director of nurses, the consultant pharmacist, the medical director, all in a think tank, maybe even along with some floor nurses, since they're the ones that have to work day in and day out with our COVID patients, with their PPE and all their risks, and actually having a think tank that comes together with what a protocol is. The more uniform the protocol can be, the easier it will be to administer it accurately. And the more informed the staff is, the more likely they'll follow it. So I am all for a team approach. But I will also say there's some organizations whose consultant pharmacists are not as involved in direct patient care. They do chart reviews instead of medication regimen reviews. They're still out there. And that may be a case where the medical director has to take control and set the protocol. Mm-hmm. I wish I could tell you that it was a Pollyanna world out there and we all work together, but that's not always the case.
Yeah, no, I think I've been on both sides of that equation. So no misconceptions here. I know we didn't give enough time as I'm being told in the chat for any more questions, but if you have questions, I know we only have 4 minutes left, please speak up or put it into the chat. I will say this, Dana, I think I've asked you like 1,001 things. You're just a wealth of knowledge and information, and I thank you for sharing everything. And would you be open to any of our participants emailing you directly if they had a question?
I'd be happy to do that. I will also openly share that the protocol that I've arrived at is one that I found online that is developed by the Eastern Virginia Medical School, and I shared that link with you, Diane, and if you would like to share it out to the group, I'm fine with that too. I don't 100% agree with everything that they have, but what I love about it, I do agree with 90% of it, and I like that they have a prophylaxis protocol, a mildly symptomatic at-home protocol, a mildly symptomatic hospitalized protocol, and then a myriad of recommendations once people begin to have a more severe disease process in the hospital. It's simply laid out. That's where I got a lot of the insight to start researching. So I'll give them kudos if you want to share that as well.
Yeah, so put that on into our FAMDA COVID library database that Shane created. So it is available to everyone who is on this call. We will make sure you have Dana's email address, and I thank you all for your attendance and your questions, and I thank you, Dana. I apologize for not having your title slide in this version of the deck, sometimes I'm working with multiple PowerPoints at the same time. But I thank you for just being so open. And I look forward to seeing you at our virtual conference in the upcoming weeks.
Yes, I'm happy to participate. And it's been a delight to be on the call today. So yes, if you have questions, feel free to email me.
Thank you.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.